This is the most dreaded Sunday of the year to try to construct a sermon. It's Trinity Sunday, folks. So what do we do with it? Two for sure starting points. Mainly, as I mentioned last week, all religious language is metaphorical. There is no univocal statement that can be made about God. We go back to the great tradition. There are two kinds of theology from the very beginning, almost. One is called apophatic theology, or negative theology. And it refers to this impossibility of speaking directly about God. The other is cataphatic theology, which is much rarer. Francis of Assisi was an exponent of it. And it holds that everything you see in the world, all the good things you see in the world, you can say in an infinite measure, whatever that means, about God. So, at least I find myself stuck between a rock and a hard place. I mean, where do you begin with this stuff? Another thing that is very helpful, and Ian mentioned it again right before Mass, all of these dogmas, every one, was created in opposition to some other intellectual tendency within the church at that time. So that's the ground on which I say that you cannot say positively what God is, but a dogma excludes other possibilities. So you create a kind of silhouette and dogmatic decrees. You know what's on the outside of the silhouette, but the difference between other silhouettes, you don't know what's on the inside of the silhouette. So in a very real way, we're stuck. As a preacher, I feel particularly stuck, pinioned to this inaccessibility. But I don't think it's totally feckless. Two things I want to remind you of. God, if it's really God we're talking about, is precisely ineffable. The Latin word simply means unspeakable about. You can't get a language about God that's adequate, except in this exclusionary fashion, as I said. And again, that God is ultimately mysterious, so you can't attribute, my neighbor's house got blown up by the tornado, mine did not. That's the work of God. It's not the work of God, folks. We don't know what God does. We don't know why God chooses to do, except that everything, and this is, requires a very strenuous act of faith, is done for our good. We do not feel that quite often. If I were a Jew in Birkenau, I would not see God in that light. And I point, and it's a very useful example. There's a writer, he's still alive, Elie Wiesel. I think he may even have appeared in London. Elie Wiesel was a kid and was taken to Auschwitz. And he saw his parents cremated in the Nazi fashion, along with the rest of his family, and he survived. And that experience acted as a purgative. He left Auschwitz as an atheist. But he came back to his native Judaism with, you can be sure, a radically different understanding of who God was. And so it's important when we think about God to remember those piles of corpses thrown by a bulldozer into an open grave, one on top of the other. Was God absent in Auschwitz? Originally, Wiesel, who was a marvelous guide in this matter. He's written lots and lots of books under the rubric Lest We Forget. They're eminently worth reading. His first book, significantly, was called Night, in an atheist age. And then his second book was called Dawn. And they're little bitty books, and I'm certain they're still in print, and I recommend them highly to you. But a couple things I've said in the past few weeks are applicable here, namely the mystery of God, and then several weeks ago I talked about God as a community of self-emptying realities, which in their very self-emptying constitute another person of the Trinity. Again, logic does not serve us well here, I don't think. But there you have it. God, if God is love, as I take very seriously that line from the Gospel of John, if God is love, then the reality of God, whatever it is, how beyond description it is ultimately self-giving. So the Father gives himself utterly to the Son, and vice versa, and they give themselves to the Spirit. And so there we are, and I confess, after literally struggling with this for the past week, I cannot add much more than that. God is love. We don't, well, and this at least is all of this is poor. I don't know what it is to love. I really do not. Well, I didn't put strychnine in my kid's soup for several years, so that was a loving thing to do. But in order to love, you have to know the other profoundly, and yourself. And I strongly suggest that none of us achieve that transparency. None of us. We would like to think we do. We'd like to think we know the other, and we'll come up with some psychobabble. We have a whole lexicon of words to just paranoid, schizophrenic, you know, blah, 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 blah. And so it goes, neurotic, blah, 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 blah. And so it goes over and over again. But the practical consequence of acknowledging that God is love and we are supposed to be turned into God, turned into love, it should not surprise us that we're sort of hamstrung again about what it is to love. Most of us in this room have kids. I can testify absolutely to the fact that I do not know my kids well enough in order to love them. Just went to the bank this afternoon to pay off an enormous debt that Dudenay owed some usurious lenders at the corner of Adelaide and Dundas. 300% interest. And he's been doing it for years. So I gave him this big pile of money. Does that mean I love him? No. I mean, he's gonna sink or get starved to death or get kicked out of his house. So I didn't do that. That's love at the most meager. That's baby step love. And Dudenay certainly doesn't know who he is. We used to fight about that with great regularity when he was living with me. Oh yeah, I know who I am. Okay, Dudenay, sure you do. All right, we left it at that. It is an enormously humbling admission to say, as Merton says in one of his wonderful words, I do not even know who I am. And a fortiori then, I do not know who you are. And therefore my attempts to love are basically experiments. So we must ride lightly to this assessment of what this other human being needs, who they really are, what it is to love. I mean, we do sometimes not too bad a job. I've not had a suicide in my family thus far, so that's promising. But much more than that, I can't say. And as I said, we live in this wonderful technologized civilization, if it's a civilization. It is, yeah. And we can't stand darkness. We cannot stand not knowing. And we have this wonderful, naive faith that soon it will all be illumined. We'll find the best computer. We'll find the best form of psychotherapy. We'll find the best forms of psychological taxonomy. And then we'll have beat it. I suspect everybody in this room has an inkling that's whistling past the graveyard. Because that's what we're called to do. It's infinitely preferable, in any case, on very practical ground, to the conceit that we really do know what that other person needs in their heart of hearts. We can be comforted by that, I believe. I really do believe we can be comforted by that. At least it wipes away the arrogant assumption that we make so normally that we know what should be done and who should be doing it, except in the most primitive way. We don't put cyanide in the kid's soup. So, again, the mystery of who I am is illuminated by the fact that I do not know who my kids are, and it is all subsumed into the fact that I do not know who God is. We search for God. We search for God, having this vague intimation. And this is where cataphatics make sense to me. I hear certain pieces of music, and I'm left panting for more. There must be more. I see certain faces, certain scenes in nature, and there must be more than all of this. There must be more. And that more, as Paul says, is hidden with God in Christ.